Home. She pressed her lips hard against his and left the gymnasium. She couldn't risk using the tunnel. Miss Nelson might be in it, and the hatch on the other end would likely be bolted. She would have to go above ground. There was one advantage tonight, a blue sulfuric fog. This would likely be her only protection against the men with the shotguns. The air was bitingly cold now, and the fog went into her nose and mouth, tangling its way down into her lungs. She was up by the library, and in theory, she only had to make a straight shot across the top of the green to get home. But the door would obviously be guarded, and the entire area exposed. She would have to take the long route around, all the way through the far end of the campus, through the half-finished sites down near the road. She stayed low, moving from one tree to the next. She tripped over the roots and branches, and the leaves crunched under her feet. She saw the first gunmen in their overalls and coats, their shotguns slung over their shoulders. There were three of them, talking together by the cupola. She got down, her heart beating fast. They would shoot tonight. They would not hesitate. For one second, she tried to imagine the hot bullet sinking into her chest, the impact. It made her heart race painfully and her hands grew slick. She considered calling out, asking them for help. They would take her home to Minerva. She would get in trouble, but she wouldn't get shot. No, she pressed to the ground. She would be a cat. They loved cats here. "Cats know best," Albert Ellingham would say. She would slink and slide. It was a big campus. She had the courage. Tonight, she would prove herself. The hardest part would be crossing the road. That was the most open area. She would have to climb down the decline into the woods and cross somewhere in the dark. Frances made her way down the steep slope. Her expensive coat caught on brambles and made her trip, so she tucked it up and crab-walked her way down several feet. If she tried to stand, she was likely to tumble and hit every tree and rock all the way to the river. The rock cut her hands as she grabbed at the ground. Everything smelled of dirt and decaying leaves.
"What's that?"
one of the men said. She froze. A light shone through the trees.
"Probably an animal,"
another replied. Frances was very close to being sick. She swallowed hard and waited, not moving an inch. She froze. It must have been 15 or 20 minutes later before she moved again. Once she had made it a good distance from the statues and the men, she crept to the road's edge and, taking a deep breath, she ran across. It was a very slender road, so it was just a few steps. She fell into the culvert on the other side and bashed her face, but she did not cry out. She crawled on her belly into the dark. Then she went back up the hill. This was much harder. Her breath was labored now. Cops and robbers, G-men and guns, sneaking in the dark. And she was doing it. Frances Josephine Crane, the flower princess of Fifth Avenue, was crawling through the dirt and the night. She dug her nails into the ground with determination, not caring about breaking them. She didn't care about her clothes or her shoes. This was life. She crested the top of the incline and emerged on the other side of the road. Now she had to wind her way back up to Minerva. She moved slowly, working her way from building to tree to statue. The fog wrapped around her like a fur coat. It was easy. By the time she reached Minerva, she no longer worried about how she would get back inside. She would simply find a way. The door would be locked, but the window of her room was not. She went around the back of the building, then peered around the corner. No one was outside. She crept along and made her way to room 2. She tested the window first, trying to push it open. It did not give. Dottie's room? Dottie was a sneak, too. Did Dottie leave her window propped? She sometimes talked about liking to have it open a bit, how it reminded her of home, with the open window by the fire escape. She crept over to room 3 and looked at the window of the dark room. There was a tiny, tiny gap, only as wide as Frances's finger. But it was enough. She got a stick and levered it up, ever so carefully. then pushed it, working slow and silent. Then she hoisted herself inside and closed it, inch by precious inch. She was inside Dottie's room, which, while technically like her own, was so much shabbier. There were no fur throws, no special furniture, no skis, no trunks of extra clothes, no radio or phonograph. Just what the school provided, and books, piles of books, neat and all over. Frances went to the door and, seeing no one, stepped out into the hallway and... Frances Crane! The overhead light came on and Miss Nelson stood there, looking flushed and furious. Frances Crane, the flower princess of Fifth Avenue and future outlaw, was busted cold just footsteps from her door. She opened her mouth to speak, though she was not sure what she would say. Something would come out. Miss Nelson, though she was in charge, was generally passive. She would say she was sorry, and... Miss Nelson was not passive tonight. Her rounded features looked sharper, and there was something in her face that suggested she knew exactly where Frances had been.
In here,
Miss Nelson said coldly, pointing to the common room. Behind her, a figure appeared, a man in overalls and a flat cap, holding a shotgun. Frances forgot to look surprised at this, and Miss Nelson's eyes grew narrow. Frances had given it all away. She did as she was told, going into the common room where one lamp was lit. The man with the shotgun went to the front window to look out.
You will sit there,
Miss Nelson said, pointing to the couch.
And you will not move at all. You will sleep there.
She turned to the man by the door.
She doesn't move from that spot,
Miss Nelson said. 6. The great house would never fail to impress Stevie. This was exactly the effect it was intended to have. It was Albert Ellingham's palace, designed by several of the most famous architects and designers of the era to be a showstopper. The wood was rosewood, imported from India. The pink marble, the Austrian crystal, the Scottish stained glass. Everything in sight had been brought from some corner of the world for the express purpose of being part of this room, just to be seen, to be admired by Albert Ellingham and all he chose to invite. Right next to the front door, there was a head of steel-colored, closely cropped hair, and under it was Larry, as dependable as a grandfather clock, sitting at his large wooden desk. He was staring grimly into an Ellingham mug.
Hey, Larry, Stevie said. What's wrong with your coffee?
Some jackass bought pumpkin-flavored K-cups for the machine. If I wanted to ruin my day like that, I'd go ahead and eat a candle.
Not a PSL fan.
A what?
A door to the small security room behind him was tipped open. This had originally been one of the Ellingham receiving parlors. When Stevie had last seen it, it had some desks and a few monitors. Now the furniture had been removed on two walls and replaced by narrow control desks that faced walls of large mounted screens stacked too high, showing every angle of Ellingham Academy, with the views switching every 10 seconds or so.
That looks complete, she said.
Let me give you the tour,
he replied, standing up.
Come in.
Stevie followed cautiously. If Larry was showing her the security system, it was for a reason. He took a seat and typed something on a keyboard. Stevie's name came up on one of the screens. Then he began to see her morning's journey told in reverse. There she was at the great house door. There she was approaching the great house. There she was walking down a pathway alone. She stopped to stare at one of the cameras. She was scowling at it. There she was, leaving breakfast. There was a close-up of Nate, Janelle, and Stevie going in to breakfast.
How is it doing this? She said. Facial recognition?
Sometimes it gets it wrong. And it's not very useful at night, but overall, it's not bad. There are also sensors in different locations that can read your ID at 6 feet. They call them listening posts. There are over 800 of them.
He hit return and her images were cleared.
Here's the thing,
Larry said.
People don't tend to change their behavior without reason. But make people see why they should.
Point made, Stevie said. I get it. You see it all.
Larry did the thing where he pointed two fingers toward his own eyes and then to her.
And you leave any further inquiries to the appropriate authorities. Not that there will be any further inquiries.
Appropriate, Stevie said. Authorities. Yes.
Good. They're waiting for you upstairs. You know the office.
Stevie backed into the main hall, then headed up the grand sweeping staircase. On the landing, there was the painting of the Ellingham family, done by their friend Leonard Holmes Nair. You couldn't just walk by the painting. It demanded to be seen. It wasn't overly large, maybe 4 feet high, which was nothing in proportion to the space. It was the color that gripped you first. The blue and yellow that swirled through the sky and slipped into the figures of the family. The bodies were almost an afterthought. The faces were the focus. And they blended in with the moon and the trees. It was like the landscape and the skyline were absorbing them, pulling them apart from each other and away from the world. It was a frightening painting.
Yes, a voice said, but we have that. We don't need it. We'll get it in a year or two.
The voice belonged to Dr. Jenny Quinn, the assistant head of the school, the one who looked like she drank student tears and ate lesser academics.
He wants to have a say, Jenny.
That was Dr. Charles Scott. They were having a discussion directly above her, on the third floor landing. They were not speaking loudly, but the acoustics in the hall were better than most theaters, and Stevie was directly under them.
He shouldn't have a say. Do you really want to be part of his narrative? Do you want him to be able to say he made Ellingham safe?
That had to be a reference to Edward King. Stevie backed up a bit to make sure she was not visible, but there was no hiding from Larry, who saw her lingering.
No,
Dr. Scott said.
I don't like him any more than you do. But wouldn't you rather have him do this? At least it's useful. He feels like he's done something and then he'll go away, hopefully. He's not going to go away. The man is a disease and his son isn't much better. I think that's unfair,
Dr. Scott said.
Isn't it worth trying to make him into someone who could do some good, rather than become a copy of his father at some prep school somewhere? I think you're fooling yourself. I want to have a board meeting, and I'm fine with that. Right upstairs, Stevie,
Larry said, his voice booming up the steps. The conversation above her stopped abruptly, and a few seconds later, Dr. Scott appeared next to her, having come down the back steps, the ones the servants used. Dr. Charles Scott, a.k.a. Call Me Charles, was the head of the school and Stevie's advisor. Out of all the Ellingham faculty, he had the most bouncy personality, the one that said, learning is fun, in giant Comic Sans. He tended to dress in expensive geek chic, superhero t-shirts with designer jeans. His hair was somewhere between blonde and the earliest hints of gray. Today he wore a fitted black cashmere V-neck and gray wool pants, looking every inch the aged version of the perfect New England preppy guy. He sproinged up to her like a cartoon tiger.
Hey, he said, look who it is. I'm so glad your parents changed their minds.
Me too, she said.
Come on, let's talk.
Charles's office was along the right-hand corridor. All of the upper floors of the great house were open to the main foyer, except for the attic. The dark wooden doors were all very serious and handsome, but for Dr. Scott's, which had a message board full of stickers and signs that said things like, Challenge me, and Stand back, I'm going to try science. His office had been Iris Ellingham's dressing room, the famous dressing room that Flora Robinson disappeared into the night of the kidnappings. Many of the original features were still there. The pale silver wallpaper glowed bright in the autumn morning light. That was the real thing. Stevie recognized it from the photos. Some of the shelves and wall fittings were still there. Now, of course, The room was also full of bookshelves, a desk, chairs, file cabinets, a printer. Any open space on the wall was covered in Dr. Scott's diplomas and certificates. He had a lot. He waved Stevie into a chair and sat behind his desk, where he clasped his hands together.
"How are you, Stevie?"
he asked. "Fine." He nodded and examined her for a moment, taking in her expression and body language. She straightened up.
"I can't tell you how happy I was to hear you were coming back," he said. "It's very brave what you're doing, after all that's happened."
"It's fine," Stevie said. He made a noise of satisfaction.
"You may have noticed we have some new security around here,"
he said. "I saw."
"It may provide you with an additional layer of reassurance. Nothing is going to happen here. We had some tragic events this semester, but that's behind us."
Both Larry and Call Me Charles had now brought up the security system. Both had their reasons, but were they also telling her they knew Edward King brought her back? If so, why not just say it? Maybe no one knew. It was possible. Whatever the case, it was making her paranoid.
"Do you feel ready to get back to work?"
he asked. Stevie felt very ready to get back to her work, which was dealing with the fact that she had made the first major breakthrough in the Ellingham case in 80 years. But he probably meant schoolwork, and the answer to that was no, she was not ready for that. "Definitely," she lied.
"I've messaged all your teachers, so we'll get you back up to speed. There may be some bumps along the way, but we'll work it out."
There was a clock ticking somewhere in the room, loud, like a bomb. She glanced around for where the noise was coming from and saw a heavy green marble clock on the mantel, surrounded by books and framed photographs. "Was that clock there before?" she asked.
"No," Charles said. "We were rearranging some things from Albert Ellingham's office, and I brought it up here. Isn't that a beauty? The story is that it belonged to Marie Antoinette. I don't know if that was ever proven. I heard there was a piece of Marie Antoinette's porcelain here at some point."
"A shepherdess," Stevie said. Charles blinked behind his Warby Parkers. "Iris collected antique French porcelain," Stevie said.
"Of course you would know about that," he said. "Anyway, it seemed so sad to have something so beautiful in a room no one really goes in. It should be looked at. But let's keep to the subject at hand. Do you know this book?"
He pulled a copy of Truly Devious, The Ellingham Murders by Dr. Irene Fenton from a stack of books on his desk. Stevie had worn this book through. It was the first read many people did on the subject. Stevie nodded.
"I assumed so. I got a call from the author. Dr. Fenton teaches at the University of Vermont in Burlington. She's working on an updated version, and she's looking for a research assistant. We've placed several students at the university as research assistants. In your case, I don't think we've ever had such a good fit for a project. How would you feel about doing that?"
Stevie tried not to actually bounce in the seat, but this was unsuccessful. Her spine became a spring, and she bolted up. Life had handed her a gift, a beautiful, unexpected gift. "What would I have to do?" she asked.
"Organize research, check facts."
Charles said it all casually, as if this wasn't the greatest thing in the world.
"I can give you some credit for English and history for the work, as well as credit toward your individual project. And because of all the work you've done on this subject already, I can advance you a little time and credit to make up for anything you've lost."
She was already nodding. "Thanks," she said.
"You never have to thank me for work you've done yourself, and I figured you would say yes, so I've set up your first meeting for tomorrow. Take the Burlington coach in the morning. She'll meet you at the Skinny Pancake at noon. It's a coffee and crepe place on the waterfront. You'll like it. Very popular. Sound all right?"
It sounded better than all right.
"Now,"
he opened his laptop.
"Let's get you updated on all your units for your classes as well. I don't know if you happened to continue any work on your reading or your language learning modules." Ha
ha ha ha ha ha ha ha ha ha. A half hour later, with a new schedule and an alarming set of personal academic benchmarks to meet, Stevie was released back into the wild, feeling a confusing blend of joy and terror, which was often a ticket to a ride on the anxiety roller coaster. There were people around, and she could have spoken to any of them. She could find Janelle and Nate and Vi. They would be happy to talk to her. Stevie was not going to do any of those things. She often found that when everything felt a little too much, she could not talk to anyone, even if she actually wanted to. She had a tendency to go where other people were not, to step into shadows when people walked toward her. She had a fondness for headphones and screens and ducking away, even as part of her wanted to be with friends, which meant she was going to the library to find some people who were probably dead. Namely, she was going to find Frankie and Edward, and Frankie and Edward were most likely to be found in the materials she had been hoping to get from Kyoko Obi, the school librarian. The library, called Asteria, was one of the campus's most magnificent buildings. Albert Ellingham thought libraries were holy spaces of learning, so he designed it to look like a small Gothic church with a turret. On the inside, it had a wild quality. Because of some architectural peculiarity, when you opened the door, it sent in a channel of air that swirled up through the open space, up and up around the balconies with their intricate spun steel metalwork that was like petrified lace. Colored light poured in from the stained glass windows that portrayed Greek titans. Helios, Selene, Metis, Eos, Leto, Pallas, and Perseus. Kyoko sat at a stool at a monumental desk, looking like a judge on high. Except in this case, the judge wore a fleece and still had the marks from a bike helmet in her hair. Kyoko also ran the school's biking club and actually went up and down the entrance path on her bike every day, a feat that should easily have qualified her for the Olympics. The library was sparsely populated. A few people sat at the massive working tables, and they all had headphones on, so it seemed okay to speak.
"You don't waste time," Kyoko said, greeting her. "I only just got the message that you were back."
Stevie meant to smile and nod, but she ended up enacting the shrug emoticon. "I need some research material," Stevie said. "On here, on the school, I need to see anything about the first class. Lists of students, for sure. Do you have those?" Kyoko nodded and took a swig from her Ellingham water bottle. She put a little sign out that said, "The librarian will be back," and waved Stevie through the dark wooden door with the words, "Library Office," written in gold. The front part of the Ellingham Library was a grand place, with its iron and glass and dark carved wood and the glorious selection of books. Many of the books had been around since the school opened in 1935. Fine, hand-picked volumes, many bound in leather, silent witnesses to the events that unfolded there. But it was the back office of the library that got Stevie excited. The back office contained the large metal shelving units of document boxes. If you loved crime, a document box was a beautiful thing. Anything could be in it. Files, clues, evidence. The document box was the thing to pick through, to find the lead, to find the single sentence on the single piece of paper that made you stand so suddenly that your head spun, and then you'd know that you cracked the case. That's how it happened in Stevie's head, anyway.
"The early archive is back here," Kyoko said, indicating one of the shelving units.
"You want the first year, 1935 through 36.
"Right," Kyoko said, heading to the end of the first row of shelves. "The 1935 through 1936 school year at Ellingham Academy was incomplete because of the kidnappings. The school's first full academic year started in the fall of 1938. You know all that."
Stevie nodded.
"It was also a very small class. It was the experiment year, so the records aren't as extensive. There was no full yearbook. However, the school had produced a guide for the first class."
She opened a folio box and removed a small cloth-bound book. On the front it read, "Ellingham Academy." The paper was thick and brownish, and the ink was a brownish red. The lettering looked hand-drawn.
"There is a box of photographs as well," Kyoko said, handing Stevie a flat storage box.
From the rattle of the contents and the weight, it didn't sound like it contained a tremendous amount.
"You can take those out into the main study room."
Stevie lifted the box and followed Kyoko back out,
then settled herself at one of the big wooden tables and switched on a work lamp. She tried to contain herself as she opened the book. The first page contained an elaborate map of the campus, indicating buildings that were complete and buildings to come. There was a letter from Albert Ellingham welcoming everyone, a list of teachers and faculty. Stevie kept flipping until she got to the students. Each one got a third of a page. Frankie was staring up at her from the bottom of the very first page of entries. There was the girl who had dressed as Bonnie Parker. Stevie read the entry underneath. Frances Josephine Crane, New York City. Birthday, February 15, 1919. Interests, chemistry, films, ballet.
Got you,
Stevie said under her breath. A few pages later, she found the next person she was searching for. Edward Pierce Davenport, Boston. Birthday, November 12, 1918. Interests, literature, opera, art. In his school photo, Edward had a rakish grin, like he knew something the others did not. A bit like David. Stevie dug through the box of photographs. Many were of the buildings or the construction sites. Some were shots of the mountain view. There were pictures of the students sitting at desks and work tables in stilted poses. One pose was a dead ringer for an ad for an ambulance-chasing legal firm with about 10 people gathered around, smiling at one open book. Many of the furnishings were exactly the same as they were now, including pictures in this very library. She easily found Frances and Edward in a few of these photos. One thing jumped out at her. Frances and Edward looked rich. Frances was wearing two different fur coats in the photos, one short white jacket and a longer dark one. Edward also had a long fur coat, and he stood with the casual ease of a rich guy, the lean, the half-smile. Could these two students have kidnapped Iris and Alice Ellingham and Dottie Epstein? That would have been impossible, surely. Someone would have noticed that two students were missing on the day of the kidnapping, right? How would they have gotten off campus? They probably didn't have cars. Why would two students kidnap Iris and Alice Ellingham? And they wouldn't have been able to also beat up George Marsh, Albert Ellingham's FBI agent friend, in the middle of the night, or make the ransom calls, or have a boat on Lake Champlain 2 days later to collect the additional ransom money. Not alone. Could they have been working with other people? Did any of this make sense? Dottie Epstein turned up in the photos as well, and she did not look rich. Her clothes were plain, and she wore the same ones in most of the photos. But she looked much happier than Edward or Frances. Her smile was always wide, and she usually had a book in her hands or under her arm. "Can I scan these?" she asked Kyoko. "Sure." She allowed Stevie into the back again and pointed her to the scanner. "When I first got here," she said to Kyoko, "you showed me some old library records, things the students requested."
"Yeah?"
"Could I see it again?"
"You really are jumping back in,"
Kyoko said with a smile.
"I'll go and get it."
When Stevie had first looked at this list, it was to see the many materials Dottie Epstein had requested. Her initials, D.E., were next to her items. But someone else had requested pulp magazines. Gun Malls Magazine, Vice Squad Detective, Dime Detective, All True Facts Detective Stories. The initials next to most of these were F.C. Frances Crane.
"Do you have any of these?" Stevie asked. "I've looked for them," Kyoko said. "I'd love to find them, but they must have disappeared a long time ago. The students who asked for them probably took them and never gave them back."
The students who took them, Stevie thought, probably took them and cut them apart. If she could find these magazines online, she could look at the letters. She could compare the typeface of those magazines to the photographs of the truly devious letter. Or someone could. The FBI. Someone. She didn't have all the answers, but she had something. Now she had to do some of the drudge work and scan all of this to add to her files. She put on her headphones, turned on My Favorite Murder, and started with the student guide. Page by page, photo by photo, she got each image. After an hour or so of this, she returned to the main study room and opened her computer. Time for a basic search. Very little turned up about Frances Josephine Crane. It looked like there were a few references to her in social registers, some notes about her debutante ball, but nothing that seemed to go past around 1940, and not in much detail. Edward Pierce Davenport, however, did turn up several things. Wikipedia had a brief entry. Edward Pierce Davenport, 1918 through 1940, was an American poet. His only published work was the 1939 collection Milk Moon. Davenport was best known for his relationships with other American expatriate writers and poets in France in the late 1930s, and for his reckless lifestyle. He committed suicide in Paris on June 15, 1940, the day the Nazis entered the city. There was a little footnote there, so Stevie clicked it. It led her to a small excerpt from a longer book. On June 15, 1940, the day after the Nazis entered Paris, Edward Pierce Davenport spent the day consuming opium and violet champagne. At sunset, as loudspeakers in the street announced the night's curfew, he donned a gold dressing gown and climbed to the rooftop of his Parisian apartment on the Rue de Rennes in Saint-Germain. After toasting the city and the setting sun, he downed a last glass of champagne and swan-dived from the building into the street below. His body landed on a Nazi vehicle, denting the roof. "A fourth-rate poet," said a friend, "but a first-rate death."
"Your friends are real dicks," Stevie said.
"I know," replied a voice. "But they're the only ones I have."
This is when the screaming started. 7. Squirrels, in Stevie's experience, were not obedient creatures, prone to forming themselves into well-regulated groups that moved as one. These squirrels were far too coordinated to her liking. They were streaming through the library, perhaps 100 of them. They were coming down the wrought iron steps, skittering along the edges of railings, all in an unbroken flow. This was only slightly more distracting than the sight in front of her. Spread out on the table was a pair of familiar hands, long, elegant hands. There was the worn-out t-shirt, strong, wiry arms. She followed these up to find brown eyes flecked with gold looking at her. Stevie yanked her legs up as squirrels began running under the tables.
"That's weird,"
David said, observing the chaos.
"So, when did you get back?"
Stevie fought the urge to hit him with her laptop, largely because she did not want to damage it.
"What did you do?" she hissed. "Me?"
"Don't be a dick," she said.
"That ship has sailed. Hang on, we can't fight yet. Where's my hug?"
"Out," Kyoko said, pointing at David. "Everyone out."
"Well, that's not conducive to learning," David said under his breath.
Stevie grabbed her stuff, sweeping one or two photos from the collection into her bag, and hurried out as Kyoko started running around the library, checking windows and closing doors. The light outside seemed overly bright after the thoughtful shade of the library. David grabbed at his neck and rubbed the stubble that had accumulated there. David Eastman, or David Eastman King, was a shade under 6 feet, his build wiry, like he had been made of bundles of snapping electrical cables that had wound themselves together into a person, sparks still coming from the ends. His clothes were always tattered, and not fashionably tattered. His jeans had not been ripped by professionals. The holes and marks on his surfer t-shirt, he had made those himself through wear and carelessness. He wore a Rolex with a shattered face on his freckled arm, along with several string bracelets. Everything on his face was too narrow, too fine, the lines sharp. His eyes always looked half-closed, but they had more life behind them than most. It's the creature that pretends to be asleep that you need to watch out for. Even in his roughest state, he was beautiful to look at. In fact, if she was being honest, he was more beautiful in this state. Except in his jaw she saw Edward King, and his smile, and everything that had made him and supported him. It was a taste she would never be able to get out of her mouth. "What the hell did you do?" she said.
I'm excited you think I'm so powerful, but I don't control the local wildlife. God, so jumpy.
I am your mandatory friend, she thought. For a second, she considered giving up right then and there. No way. No way could she carry on with whatever weird pretense. The case, the tin, the evidence, her one chance. Pix was hurrying across the green with some kind of box or carrier in her hand. She cast a look at David as she went, but did not come over to them or stop moving.
Did you know,
he said as Pix hurried on,
that Dr. Nell Pixwell is a trained wildlife conservator? One of her many skills.
What are you doing? Stevie said. Why did you send Pix to pick squirrels out of the library?
I need your help, he said. Now, we've got maybe an hour?
For what?
Ellie's room, he said. I need you to do the thing you do. Look through it.
Stevie rubbed her face in disbelief.
It's what you do, he said.
She was about to snap back that it wasn't what she did, except it was what she did. She had gone through David's room once when left alone in there just to try to find out what he was hiding from her. It turned out he was hiding a lot, so that was fair enough. And she went through Hayes's room after his death when she'd had the idea that something wasn't right, and it turned out something wasn't right. And Hayes was gone, so no harm, no foul.
No, he said. It's a good thing.
He was being serious, and his entire expression and bearing changed.
Let me ask you a question. Does Ellie seem outdoorsy to you?
Outdoorsy?
She's the only smoker I know who can't light a match, Stevie. I saw her try. It was amazing. She uses a lighter because matches are too complicated. Last winter, I seriously thought she would kill herself trying to deal with the snow. She doesn't own boots. She has zero sense of self-preservation. She can't drive. She's made to live in cities and make art stuff. Now think about what it would take to get down off this mountain by yourself. The answer is a lot. I've tried it.
I thought she snuck off all the time to go to Burlington, she said.
With me. She had friends down there with the cars. I helped them get on campus by messing with the camera at the entry gate. Ellie has a lot of talents, but she's not handy. So you're telling me that she ran away from here on no notice, carrying nothing, with no phone, no one waiting on the back drive. That she got herself across the river. She didn't use the bridge. As soon as she took off, Larry had someone on the road. That river is about 10 feet deep, rapid and cold. So she runs alone for miles through the woods in the dark, downhill, over a mountain river to the road, which is now being watched.
Okay, Stevie said. Okay, so what are you saying?
I'm saying something doesn't make sense, and I want you to do the thing you do and look through her stuff before it's gone, because you are really good at that, and I can't think of anything else. She's my friend, and I don't know where she is. If anyone could figure out where she's gone or if she's okay, maybe it's you.
Was this a trap? Because it seemed like a trap. Yet he said it plainly enough that Stevie felt it was probably the truth. David and Ellie had always been close friends. When Stevie had first arrived at Ellingham, she had watched the way they fell all over each other. Stevie thought they were dating. They weren't. They really were just friends. Also, David was not stupid. He knew that once this idea was introduced to Stevie's brain, it could only take root and grow. The vines would twist around her every waking thought until all other brain activity would be squeezed out and all that would be left would be the leafy jungle of desire to search. And the tin had come from Ellie's room.
You know you want to, he said. Janelle is over in the maintenance shed working on her project and Nate won't notice.
They had been reunited for all of 10 minutes. And already the library was infested with squirrels, and he was calling on her to break into a room. This was home. It all checked out. Minerva was quieter than normal when David and Stevie walked into the common room. The moose head on the wall was the only witness, and for a moment, Stevie wondered if it had been mounted with cameras. Moose-eye cameras. Did Edward King want to watch and see when his son got back to his dorm? A stupid thought. A nervous thought. Her palms were sweating. David was just behind her, and she could feel his shadow on her back, like it was made of fingers.
Janelle? She called.
Nothing.
Nate, you here?
The moose just stared ahead.
Told you,
David said.
All ours, nice and cozy.
Just her and David alone in the house. The whole house. Alone.
Is the door locked?
David produced a key from his pocket.
Where did you get that?
Don't worry about it,
he said. Even in the bright midday sun, the hallway in Minerva was very dark, lit only by a very tiny stained glass window by the stairs at the end of the hall. There was a wall sconce, but no one ever turned it on during the day. Stevie walked gently past Janelle's room and her own, down to the end, where room 3 lay waiting. Ellie's room was just a little bit different from Janelle's and Stevie's. It was a touch larger, with a little alcove nook. There were 3 small boxes piled there, so some of her stuff was still here, but by no means all. When Stevie had last been in this room, the bed was piled in colorful blankets and spreads. There was stuff everywhere. Art supplies, paints and pastels and pencils, boas, piles of dirty but colorful clothes, books, prints and drawings, and melted down candles, and wine bottles with peacock feathers coming out of them. Those things were all gone. The bed now looked like what it was, a small wooden institutional frame with a plastic-covered mattress. The poems and drawings Ellie had put on the wall were still there, like ancient graffiti. Quotes, song lyrics, snatches of poetry in French and English, slashes of color, crude and bright drawings, splatters. Ellie's mind was an active and colorful place, and she decorated her world with its contents. The way to handle a scene was to start wide and work your way in. So that's what Stevie did. She walked around the edge of the room first, looking at the writings and drawings, checking in the drawers and closets to see if anything had been left behind. The bureau top still had a thick covering of makeup dust and wax, as did the bedside stand. Stevie opened the closet door. There was nothing but a crumpled plastic shopping bag. When she had satisfied herself that the room itself had nothing to tell her, she went to the boxes and had a careful look through. The top one contained clothes, as David said. Ellie's thrift store finds and Parisian punk, balled-up vintage t-shirts, flowing hippie pants covered in paint, objects that defied definition. The next box contained what appeared to be the used bedding stripped off the bed, and the box below that, towels and bath supplies. Stevie looked through Ellie's mix of store-brand shower gels and shampoos and her French body oils before putting everything back in the boxes.
Anything?
David said from the window.
How are the little gray cells?
She waved him off. This room had contained everything of Ellie's here at Ellingham. She'd had the magic tin in this room. Stevie had to try harder. What did this space tell her about Element Walker? Stevie got down on the floor on her stomach and rested her chin in her hands. Old glitter still sparkled from the floorboards, and bits of feather were snagged on splintered pieces of the wood. Down here, she could smell Ellie's incense, the endless incense she burned against the school rules. No fires, Ellie, Stevie said out loud.
What?
David said from the window.
The first thing I heard about Ellie on the first day, before you got here. You were late and we were having the orientation talk thing.
Stevie scanned the room from her vantage point, a vista of dust bunnies.
Pix said to her, no fires, Ellie. Ellie must have caused a fire.
Oh, yeah, last year. She knocked a candle over.
In here?
Yeah, in here.
And yet she can't light a match, Stevie said, mostly to herself. She pushed herself back up to her knees. Where do you look for Ellie, the smoker who can't light a match? Albert Ellingham was trying to find people, too. He was always looking for his lost daughter. All of this was about his lost daughter. And now there was another lost daughter on the mountain. Against a box by the door, Stevie saw Ruta, Ellie's beloved saxophone. Ellie could not play the saxophone, but that never stopped her. She had purchased Ruta with the money Hayes gave her to write the end of it all, and that money came from Hayes's ex-girlfriend Gretchen. The day Stevie met Ellie, she was playing Ruta in the tub at the end of the hall while dyeing her dress and herself pink. It was there that Stevie discovered the bits of metal under the tub, the ones that had marked Hayes's computer when Ellie stashed it there. So much of this came down to Ruta. Stevie went over and picked up the saxophone. That's when she saw it, a scorch mark leading up to the wall. The mark had been scrubbed over, painted away, and something else. Something wasn't right in that little patch of the room.
Don't you think it's weird about the matches? Stevie said, getting down to look at the wall.
That's why I said it.
No, Stevie said. You said it to me to explain why you didn't think she would do well alone in the woods. Don't you think that's odd? Ellie's an artist. She's good with her hands. It looked like something had fallen. There was one dark mark that stretched out. But the weird thing was that something about the wall was uneven. She got right up to it and ran her hand along it to the molding between the wall and the floor. There was a gap. A tiny, tiny gap, a few millimeters.
Pass me my bag, she said to David.
He pushed her bag in her direction. She yanked it over and shuffled through it until she found a pen. She pulled off the cap and used it to pry into the space. David made his way over to her and perched next to her, sitting on his heels.
Turn on your phone flashlight, she said.
What is it?
I don't know yet, she said impatiently. Flashlight! He turned on the flashlight function. By now, Stevie had wiggled the board free. It gave rather easily. It had been pulled loose before, clearly. Behind it was a hole in the base of the wall, about the size of a fist. David had no snark now. He silently handed her the flashlight. Before she took it, she reached into the front pocket of her bag and pulled out a pair of blue nitrile gloves and snapped them on.
Really?
He said.
You carry crime scene gloves?
You can get them in any drugstore, she said, taking the phone from him. Treat yourself.
She flattened herself on the floor as best she could and turned her head to the side to get a view into the space. It appeared to be a shallow space, dark, webby. She positioned the phone's light to get the best illumination she could and reached in slowly in case there were wires or sharp edges. She poked finger by finger until she hit the back of the space. It was about as long as her hand, almost big enough for the tin, but not quite. She lifted her neck and stretched it, then reached her fingers up. There was space there. The hollow went all the way up, plenty of space for the tin.
So there is a hole?
David said.
That's pretty good. I mean, you never disappoint with your—
Shut up for a second. She craned her hand around to get a full sense of what might be there.
Maybe Janelle has one of those laparoscopic little cameras, she said. Or
her finger hit something. Something fabric.
I've got something, she said.
She wormed her fingers into the space, looking for something she could hook onto. Was it more of the beaded fabric? Or the thing the feather had come from? Was it more of the photos? A bag? The thing pulled free and landed on the floor inside the hole. She wrapped her hand around it and was pulling it out when her brain sent her the alert that something was amiss with this object. But sometimes when you start a movement, you can't stop. She pulled the thing out of the hole. Whether it was a large mouse or a small rat, she did not know. It was dead and had been for some time. It still had fur in places, but in others it was exposed to the bone. Overall, it was hard, possibly mummified by being in the wall.
Oh,
she said, jerking away her hand. It was not an adequate expression of horror, but it was all she had. When you find yourself holding a mummified mouse rat, words may fail.
That's not Ellie,
David said, looking over and grimacing. Stevie got up and scooted away from the thing. Ripping off her gloves, she shoved them in her hoodie pocket.
Are you keeping those?
He said. I can't put them in the trash in here, she replied.
You think they're checking her trash?
I don't know. You asked me to come in here.
Okay.
He held up his hands.
What do you think?
Stevie surveyed the room again. What was she wearing that night? Stevie asked.
She had ballet shoes on, he said. I remember looking at them.
And a little dress.
Ballet shoes and a little dress. He had a good point. It would be hard to get down the mountain in that.
The room told her about Ellie, that she was a freewheeling artist, an impractical dresser, a French speaker, messy. She liked wine and cabaret. She had a lot of colored pens and drawing books. Her medium was everything. She was color and glitter and chaos.
David was looking at her expectantly, waiting for her to make some kind of proclamation, but she had nothing. The room had no secrets to share. The only thing it had given her was a dead rodent, and now she had to get rid of it.
Let me think, she said.
David's phone buzzed. He looked at it.
Looks like I have a date. Gotta go up to the Great House. Someone thinks I put a bunch of squirrels in the library.
He tucked his phone in his pocket.
Thanks for looking. Maybe it was stupid.
He shrugged.
Better go.
When he was gone, Stevie found herself quaking internally. And it wasn't just because she had to scoop up the rat with some cardboard and take it out to the woods.
8. Detection has many methods, many pathways, narrow and subtle. Fingerprints. The lost piece of thread. The dog barking in the night. But there is also Google. After dumping the rat, Stevie sat down and looked up the names she had uncovered. Frances Josephine Crane had lived long before the existence of social media, long before every moment and movement could be tracked. But she still lived in a time where the life events of a prominent young woman could be traced. That she was a prominent young woman was the first thing Stevie found out when she sat down in her own room. Frances Crane was the daughter of Lewis Crane, the founder and owner of a company called Crane Flower. The internet had plenty to say about Crane Flower, one of America's most popular brands between 1910 and 1945. Many people collected Crane Flower tins. The most important fact about Crane Flower seemed to be that one of their factories exploded in 1927, killing 8 people and wounding 30. Crane was roundly denounced for insufficient safety precautions, and Crane Flower winked out of existence about 20 years later, purchased by some larger company that folded it into another company and into another. Frances hid among these stories, concealing herself in the depths of available information. Stevie caught a glimpse of her in a list of attendees at a ball held in New York on September 19, 1936. Then her name appeared in a list of the 1937 incoming class at Vassar. There was no mention of her in any list of graduates. Finally, Stevie found herself reading selections from a book called Better Than Homemade, The Story of Baking in America, which was published in 1992 and patchily uploaded in the form of a bunch of bad scans. This was the longest piece of information she could find on Frances. Lewis's daughter, Frances, was well known for her literally hell-raising ways. In despair, her parents sent her away to join the first class of their friend, Albert Ellingham's new academy in the hills of Vermont. Unfortunately, her stay there was concurrent with the infamous Ellingham kidnapping, and she returned home. The Crane family, it seemed, attracted disaster.
"What do you mean, literally hell-raising ways?" Stevie said aloud. "She literally raised hell? What, is she summoning demons?"
There were other annoying things, like the fact that the author said hills of Vermont and not mountains. So it made the claim that Frances and her family attracted disaster seem a little dubious. But still, this was an intriguing paragraph. It was also the only one that mentioned Frances. Stevie found the author's name, Anne Abbott, and read down the list of her other works. Jell-O, The Wobble That America Loves. Salad Days, How Salad Became Popular. Another few minutes of poking around produced an email address. Stevie wrote her an email and asked her if she had any information about what became of Francis. She had just sent it when there was a knock at her door, and Janelle poked her head in.
"What are you up to?"
she asked. Stevie glanced up at the corner of her screen and realized that she had been scouring the internet for Francis Crane for over 3 hours. It was almost 6:30.
"Work,"
she said, shutting her computer. "Lots to catch up on." Janelle stepped into the room. The light smell of lemons trailed in with her.
"You're wearing your lemons," Stevie said. "For luck?"
"I'm just happy you're back,"
Janelle said, sitting on the edge of Stevie's bed.
"When I'm happy, for luck, I just love lemons. Here, I made you something."
She handed Stevie a small plastic object about the size of a deck of cards with two wheels.
"It's a self-balancing robot," she said. "You can attach your phone to it." "I was playing around with some spare parts and working on inertial measurement units, and I just wanted to make you something, so..."
She shrugged happily as Stevie accepted her friendship robot.
"How's your project going?"
Stevie asked.
"I'm glad you asked. Do you want to see specs?"
Janelle bounced off the bed and returned a minute later with her laptop open. She showed Stevie several videos of machines rolling around and swinging things. She had the same intensity that Stevie had when she was talking about murders, except this was pipes and motors and things that spun and moved. All of this was interspersed with a detailed analysis of Janelle's favorite K-drama, Love Lessons with Tofu. Janelle's mind was a busy but perfectly organized place, running like one of her impossible machines. TV show plots ran alongside mathematical formulas, which blended seamlessly into smoky eye tutorials, which catapulted her into romance before dropping her gently back into a bed of physics. And also, she answered every single one of her texts within a minute. She did not, however, know about crime, and she would probably not be interested in what Stevie had just discovered, or not discovered, really, about someone who was related to someone else who made flour. Janelle's phone buzzed, and she glanced down at it.
"Everyone's going over to the yurt," she said. "Vi is on their way over."
"You and Vi seem so happy." Janelle did a tiny squee. It was an actual squee, a real one. A pip of joy.
"I'm trying to learn a little Korean," Janelle said, "but languages aren't really my thing. Vi's fluent in Korean and Japanese, and they thought I'd like to learn Korean the most. Do you want to go over?
Let's get Nate and go over."
Before Ellingham, yurts had not been a part of Stevie's life. She had never even heard of them. When she first saw the massive, circular tent structure, it reminded her of a circus, both inside and out. Outside, all big top. Inside, it was a mass of colorful rugs, bean bags, futons, and cushions. It was the place where people gathered to hang out, play games, read, do work. It was a strange structure. It had no windows, and the inside was a skeleton of sunburst beams that supported the ceiling and a lattice that held up the walls. There was a wood-burning stove in the middle that kept it all toasty, and lights and colorful decorations hung from the ceiling. Janelle and Vi sat propped up back-to-back on the floor. Nate was sitting with them, though his attention was on a game on his tablet. The school was abuzz with the story of the squirrels. It seemed common knowledge that it was David's doing, and he had not yet returned from his trip to the Great House. Back in Pittsburgh, if someone had infiltrated the library with 50 squirrels, that person would have been hailed as a hero. But Ellingham was full of library lovers, and there was the feeling in the air that this was, perhaps, a bridge too far. You could be naked, you could scream and hang out on the roof, but you do not mess with the place with the books.
"Nothing else got him kicked out,"
Nate mumbled as the topic floated up in their group.
"If they can prove it," Vi said. "I guess they have footage. They have footage of everything because now we live in a surveillance state."
Janelle rolled her eyes just a tiny, tiny bit.
"Seriously," Vi said. "People are saying those cameras we got, they're from someone on the outside. The school didn't want them."
"Then who bought them?"
Janelle said.
"I don't know. It's private, though. I know you think I'm a paranoid protester, but it's true."
Stevie bit her lower lip. It appeared that no one knew about Edward King's connection to the school. This meant that the helicopter had not been seen up close.
Stevie felt like she was sitting on a secret. Palpably. Like it was an egg. If she moved, it would crack open.
I don't know, Janelle said. I get the problem, but I don't hate the cameras. There are